Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In 2015, today's guest, Vivian Ho, was a young criminal justice reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle, covering the random murders of 23-year-old Audrey Carey and 67-year-old Steve Carter. They were both robbed at gunpoint. Audrey was murdered in Golden Gate Park. Steve Carter was murdered in Marin. Their killers were three homeless street kids, Sean Angold, Hayes Lampley, and Lila Alligood. They were addicted to drugs and part of a larger culture of runaways who come from unstable homes, foster homes, or drug-addicted homes. As Vivian Ho continued reporting on these senseless killings, she had many questions. What drove these kids into the streets in the first place? What made them stay? And in the very rare cases, what made them kill? Another very important question she asks is, how do we keep kids from homelessness in the first place? It's estimated that 3.5 million young adults and 700,000 youth have experienced prolonged homelessness at some point in their lives. Vivian Ho tried to find answers doing hundreds of hours of interviews with street kids, former street kids, advocates, and the convicted ringleader behind the killings. Vivian Ho shares her findings in her new book, Those Who Wander, America's Lost Street Kids. Vivian Ho is an award-winning journalist who works for The Guardian. Her new book is Those Who Wander, and Vivian Ho joins us in studio. Hi, Vivian. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. So you really started reporting this book in 2011 as a reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle when you first started interviewing homeless youth for the first time, right?
It was really, really, really almost kind of kismet. It was my very first story as a Chronicle reporter brought me face to face with the world of street kids. It had nothing to do with street kids whatsoever. I just got introduced to them because there was a murder in Buena Vista Park. And just as what would happen 4 years after that with the murders of Audrey Carey and Steve Carter, anytime something happened in the area, people automatically blamed the street kids. And the murder had nothing to do with the street kids at all in Buena Vista Park, but everybody thought it was them.
What did you know about street kids before you started interviewing them?
I had no idea about the world I was entering. I thought I had a very vague idea of the homeless culture coming out here. I grew up on the East Coast. I didn't really know anything really about homelessness. The homeless culture is very different on the East Coast. And coming out to the West Coast, people warned me. They told me that the weather is better. Everybody is much more visibly homeless. Like, you know, it's a much different level. And they told me that there are people that were homeless by choice. And people were actually making a choice to be homeless. And people were just free spirits. And, you know, they wanted to live on handouts. And they wanted to be lazy and not do anything with their lives. And being 22 years old and my first job out of college, I believed them. And much of the book is all about me learning that that was very much not true.
Mm. And you also hear that from people in the Bay Area. You write about this in the book in the comments section under stories about mm-hmm. street kids, especially these horrific murders that happened in 2015.
Everyone kind of looks at them. And that's the hard thing about this. We look at these kids. We see them. And we see these young, capable, able-bodied human beings. And we look at them and we think, you could get a job. You could function in society if you wanted to. So you obviously don't want to. But we don't realize what's happening inside. We don't realize what's happening, what happened to them in the past. We don't realize what kind of traumas they suffered, what sort of ordeals that they're dealing with.
One of the first young street kids you interviewed was Dave Thompson. Can you talk about him and just how he informed your understanding of what street culture is like?
this is another hard situation with homeless by choice, that whole trope, is because a lot of these kids will tell you too, this is my choice. And you want to give them their agency. You want to respect them and accept that, you know, if they tell you it's their choice, then that, you know, go ahead. Sure, it's your choice. But that really shouldn't be where the questioning stops. The question shouldn't be, is it your choice to be homeless? The question should be, do you have the ability to not be homeless if that is also your choice? And I did not ever get the chance to ask Dave that. And I regret that to this day. Mm-hmm. And that I think about that often.
You tried to find him.
Oh, I tried to find him. And it's so funny. When I first met him, I asked him for his last name, and he you know, paused for a second, because a lot of these street kids, they go by nicknames, they go by, like, you know, their dirty kid names. Like, you know, I meet some people with, like, you know, like Hayes went by Hayes, Lila went by Mahalani, and then Dave just didn't really go by his full name. And so he wasn't comfortable giving me his full name. And I, you know, I was telling him, I'm like, you know, like, your name is Dave Thompson. It's generic. Like, nobody's going to be able to connect you with Dave Thompson. Like, it can be anybody. And we were joking about that. And he's like, yeah, that's fine. And yeah. And so he told, and so Dave Thompson, it came back to haunt me later, because I was searching for it. And there are hundreds and hundreds of Dave Thompsons in all over the country, and I could not find him.
Let's talk about these horrific murders that happened in 2015. I think what was so interesting about reading the book is we all read about the murders. Mm-hmm. They're so close to home here in San Francisco, and they were senseless and horrific. But I guess I just didn't know the details around the lives that these people lived. And you know, especially for, well, we'll talk about both of them, but 23-year-old Audrey Carey, these were just horrific random murders. How did you go about learning about who these people were? Audrey Carey, for example, let's first talk about her.
Audrey Carey, that was hard, because I reached out to her family a few times, and they just did not want to speak about this, which is completely understandable. It's when you lose somebody, I respect that. They'd spoken to some members of the Quebecois press, and I was able to learn some details about her from there. And she was a free spirit. A lot of what was interesting, a lot of what brought her to San Francisco was the same sort of free spirits, free thinking, and wandering hearts that is behind a lot of the kids who are searching for something more, and a lot of the street kids.
She was actually, so she's from Canada, mm-hmm. and she was planning to go to law school.
Yes.
And she decided that for the time being, she didn't want an 8-to-5 job. She did not want to work in a cubicle. She wanted to just figure out who she is. So she comes to San Francisco with $600 in her pocket.
It's totally relatable, you know.
Right.
It's everybody has had that feeling at some point. And, you know, for, she was just a kid, what it comes down to, and that's what's so heartbreaking about it. She was just a kid who was trying to figure out her life. And she wrote her mom right before she was killed that she thought that she was slowly figuring out what she wanted.
So what happened when Audrey was in Golden Gate Park one day and she ran across Sean Hayes and Lila? I mean, that's the other hard part, is Sean Hayes and Lila gave different stories, and there were lots of lies in the book, and we'll talk about that in a minute. I just wondered, mm-hmm. as a journalist, how did you decide what to print, because the stories were contradictory, and Hayes would say one thing. He was kind of the ringleader. And then you'd find out that that wasn't true. So at the end of the day, how do we know? Do we know what really happened to Audrey?
I don't know if we'll ever really truly know.
Yeah.
That's the hardest part. You know, it's we all have different versions of the truth. And what I was able to do in the book is just present several different versions of the truth. And we know that somewhere in there is the actual truth. And that's all we can really hope for at this point. and just really take from that what we can. And that's all we can really do as journalists. And it's frustrating as hell, but it's all we can really do, right?
And we'll talk more about these three, but can you tell us how they got their hands on a gun?
Oh, that was a huge situation when the story broke in local media, because it was very maddening. People are frustrated. People are really, really upset. It was a pretty outrageous situation. A gun owner left his gun in his unlocked car, and he left it there overnight, fully loaded with his ammunition. And they were car hopping, which is just pulling the handles on cars and just seeing, you know, it's kind of like roulette, just seeing, like playing a luck. And they found a lucky one, and it was the ultimate jackpot that they found. Wow. A gun.
So they basically go and just see what car is unlocked.
See what cars are unlocked.
And then see what they can find.
And in this case, it was a loaded firearm.
So Audrey was shot and killed in Golden Gate Park.
She was shot and killed in Golden Gate Park. She met the three that afternoon. They spent the afternoon together. It was a typical San Francisco meetup situation. You know, just you're walking around and you just run into people and suddenly you're friends. And it was one of those magical moments that it could have gone a totally different way,
right,
had it been another group of people. And I think that's what she really wanted. I think she was looking for connections like that.
Well, that's what was so sad to me, is here's this young woman who is coming to San Francisco trying to find herself, and she stumbles upon these three, obviously they're street kids, and she was probably curious and thought, you know what, let me sit down and chat with them. And
exactly.
Just, who am I?
Exactly.
It's that whole process.
Exactly. And right before she died, she actually thanked them for being her friends.
Wow.
And then they robbed her. They all claimed that the plan was that they just wanted to rob her. But once the gun came out, then it all went south.
Hmm. Obviously, after this happened, they were afraid, especially Sean and Lila. And Hayes, and we'll talk about these three in a minute, but I really wanted to first talk about the people who were murdered out of respect for them and their mm-hmm. families. Hayes claimed to have some property in Oregon. And so they said, we've got to get out of here. Let's go to this property. Well, in order to get there, they needed a car. So talk about how they got from San Francisco to Marin.
Well, so what was interesting was that Hayes and Lila, they were in a romantic relationship, and they were planning on going to Oregon already. They were making their way up north, and they stopped in San Francisco, and they met Sean Engold. And after Audrey Carey happened, Sean kind of joined in on their plans, basically. They were just kind of slowly making their way up, but as they were walking up and just trying to hitchhike, trying to get their way up, they realized it was just taking far too long. In 2 days, they only made it up to Marin County. And so they realized they needed a car. And that's when Steve Carter came into the picture.
And again, such a senseless, random killing. He was sadly in the wrong place at the wrong time.
It could have been any of us.
It could have been any of us. And Steve's story is so horrific, because can you talk about why he and his partner decided to leave Costa Rica to come to Marin in the first place?
It was incredibly heartbreaking. It was because Lokita Carter, Steve Carter's wife, was diagnosed with breast cancer. And so they were in Marin County so she could get treatment. At that time, like, imagine thinking that this is going to be your hardest battle as a married couple. This is going to be the hardest thing that you will have to overcome. And then to be served with this complete shock of having your husband murdered like that.
You write that Steve wanted to go on a quick walk with his dog, and he asked Lokita to join him, but she was too tired. And mm-hmm. she said, just pick me up afterwards and we'll go to meditation.
Yeah.
And so he drove up. he actually saw, we think, he saw the three mm-hmm. and went to another parking lot before he decided to take his walk.
He did. And what he didn't realize, though, is that Lila Olligood had chosen him already. She marked him as the one that she wanted to rob because she said he looks older. He had white hair. He was very healthy. He was outdoorsy. He was very able-bodied. But he had white hair, and she said, "The old man. We can take the old man." And they marked him, and so they followed. So he went down the trail, and they went to the head of the trail, and they waited for him to come out.
And again, it's hard to know what happened because it's basically their word, and in many cases, they have very different stories. But based on what you pieced together, what do you think happened at that point?
It's this is where it gets really, really almost it gets very tough because Hayes Lampley told me a very unbelievable tale about what happened, essentially. He told me that it was an accident. He told me that he tripped and he held down the trigger and he accidentally shot Steve Carter. But he emptied the clip. That's what but investigators said, that the clip was emptied. Steve Carter was shot multiple times. Steve Carter's dog, Coco, was shot. So he had to have tripped and fell and held on the trigger again and again and again and again. And then he kept, and then just questioning him over and over again, he kept going back to the same thing, that I always see things through, is what he told me. And when I kept asking him, I'm like, what do you mean I always see things through? And he said, like, you know, like, we were just going to rob him. And he claims, they always maintained it was just going to be a robbery. But if anything went badly, he will see it through. And I'm just like, but what do you mean if it's, anything goes badly? And he's just like, I just see things through. And so you just don't know. It's hard to figure out what to believe.
Right. And then you, of course, wonder, why couldn't they just rob him and steal his car and not shoot him?
Exactly. Exactly. But it's I think it's definitely one of those situations where you did it once and then you do it again because it was easier.
You have spoken to Steve's wife, Lakita. In fact, she read your book.
She read the book, yeah.
What were your conversations with her like, and what was her reaction to your book?
I don't think... if you were somebody who lost what she has had lost, I don't think you could ever read a book like this and say, like, oh, I loved it. But she told me she appreciated it for what it was, and that meant the world to me. Because from the start, I struggled with this so much. I wanted to be respectful of the families of Steve Carter and the families of Audrey Carey. I wanted to be respectful, but at the same time, the whole premise of this is, how do we prevent other families from having to suffer what they've suffered as well? How do we stop kids from ending up in the streets and ending up in situations where they might resort to violence in the same way that Hayes Lampley, Lila Olligood, and Sean Engel did during that weekend in 2015.
I wondered that throughout the book, is how did you balance that? Being respectful to the families, but really diving deep into these questions that are so important.
It was just, I always had to remember that this was not an excuse. Just because I was digging in, just because we asked the question why, doesn't mean we're excusing. We're excusing what they did. Nothing excuses murder. There's no excuse for murder. There's no excuse for what these three individuals did. But why they did it is a question that we should always be asking.
Today we're speaking with award-winning journalist Vivian Ho about her new book, Those Who Wander, America's Lost Street Kids. The questions Vivian asks are very important. What drove these kids into the streets in the first place? How do we keep kids from homelessness? You spent a lot of time trying to understand why these three did it and just what their backgrounds were, what led them to this point. Again, we're talking about Sean Angold, Hayes Lampley, and Lila Aligood. You spent time interviewing Hayes. You also spoke with his mom, and you interviewed just a number of advocates who have firsthand experience with all of this. What really struck me was just the stories that they told you, the lies that they told you, things that just didn't make sense. So how did you deal with all of that? How did you decide what to share?
It was very difficult, to say the least. With Hayes Lampley, he lied to me fairly often, and from the start, it was easy to catch him in the lies. And just when I caught him in the lies, I called him out on them, and then he would always reason a way out of it. And I stopped trying to look at them as a gotcha moment. The lies weren't a way for me to call him a liar, but the lies for me told me more about who he was as a person. Why was he still trying to rewrite his history? Why was he trying to rewrite what was happening? What are his motivations for lying? And it wasn't even just to make himself look better or make himself look sympathetic. Some of them are just the silliest, weirdest, most innocuous sort of lies ever. But he would tell it to me, and I would just think about it, like, why did you do that? And it told me more about his character and what he was trying to escape, and the reality he was trying to escape more than anything else.
His father, Hayes's father, was a drug addict. Hayes told you that he bounced from home to home. He said that he was sexually abused by his father, but you couldn't confirm that.
I could not confirm that. And that's also the trouble with allegations like that. You know, there are only two people who can really truly confirm that, the victim and the sexual abuser. In this case, his family denies that any kind of sexual abuse happened. But Hayes Lampley, just speaking to him and talking to him, his demeanor and the way he spoke to me, the way he lied to me, his hypersexuality, all of it. He just from my experiences talking to sexual assault victims, I believe that he was sexually assaulted at some point in his life. Was it by his father? I don't know. But I believe that he did suffer some kind of sexual abuse.
We're going to take a quick break. We're speaking with Vivian Ho, an award-winning journalist. She was a criminal justice reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle when these senseless murders happened of 23-year-old Audrey Carey and 67-year-old Steve Carter. And as she continued reporting on these murders, a number of questions came up. What drove these kids into the streets in the first place? What made them stay? And in the very rare cases, what made them kill? Vivian is now a reporter with The Guardian, and she's out with a new book, Those Who Want America's Lost Street Kids. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is a rebroadcast of a show we did a few weeks ago. We're not taking phone calls this morning. We do love reading your comments. Write to yourcall@kalw.org. On tomorrow's Friday Media Roundtable, we look at the first year since the killing of Washington Post's writer Jamal Khashoggi at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. Coming up in a half hour on 1A at 11 o'clock, when is standing your ground not worth standing on your ground? Also talk with Republican candidate Mark Sanford on 1A coming up in a half hour here on KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you have a show idea, a guest idea, or feedback for us, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our podcast where you can leave us a review. Today, we're joined by award-winning journalist Vivian Ho. She is a former San Francisco Chronicle reporter who's now working at The Guardian, and she's out with an important new book called Those Who Wander, America's Lost Street Kids. She tells the stories of the senseless murders of 23-year-old Audrey Carey and 67-year-old Steve Parker. They were robbed at gunpoint in 2015 in the Bay Area by three homeless street kids. And one of the very important questions she asks is, how do we keep these kids from homelessness in the first place? Let's go to Susan in San Francisco. Hi, Susan. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much. San Francisco was built by runaways. It was built by people running away at first for the gold rush. It was people running away to build the railroad. It was young people running away to get away from their families for whatever reason, to find fortune, like the young girl with the $600 that got killed. She was running away to San Francisco. That's the nature of this town. I ran away in 1966, where 150,000 kids ran away at one time to be on the streets of San Francisco looking for something that was authentic and trying to get away from the Vietnam War. The nature of the town is freedom. It's pioneering. And the idea that you're going to somehow stop this, it's like, you know, going up to the gold country and going, oh, why did this mountain man kill this young guy from St. Louis who came up here to pan for gold? It's like, it's none of our business. It's none of our business. It's always happened. It's always going to happen. What's different with these kids, and number one, that's a legend that 150,000 kids. What was different at that time was there was a really supportive, nurturing, Buddhist-intended community to take those kids, like the Diggers and all of the people that helped those kids, the Haight-Ashbury Medical Clinic that built up around that to help with their medical problems. Now, we are in the Wild West again, and to be a traumatized, and I want to really stress that word, all of those 150 kids, a lot of them that came to San Francisco were traumatized.
Right. They were traumatized. Susan, thank you for calling in. Let's talk about the trauma that so many of these kids face. You interviewed a number of the kids. You also interviewed advocates who used to be street kids. You've got so many stories in the book. And I think this is so important because society just, it doesn't directly talk about these issues, especially the really difficult ones where kids are sexually abused by, in some cases, and I'm sorry, I should say this will be triggering for some people and not appropriate for children. I should have mentioned that at the top of the show. There's so much triggering happening in the, you know, in the news these days, but I'd like to give warning. So many kids who were sexually abused by their own family members, kids who are prostituted by their own family members, kids who are forced to take drugs by their own family members. And we need to spend more time talking about this.
Definitely. And that's the problem. That's so hard to talk about because it's such an ugly reality that we don't want to talk about it. And, you know, San Francisco does have that beautiful history of taking in the runaways. But we don't look at what they need anymore. That's the problem. Like, we don't have enough resources. We don't look into how we can be helping the kids. They do have a lot of trauma. They do have a lot of hurt. And we need to be looking at how we can help those kids and help them with that help, their hurt and the trauma. Because they all have it. They have a lot of it. And they have a lot of ugly realities that we don't know about.
What has really changed when Susan talks about so many people coming to San Francisco to find out who they were or who they are in the 60s, for example? A lot of kids flocked here. What has changed from then to now when we're talking about street kids?
I would say it's the culture has been less accepting, for sure. You know, there was a summer of love atmosphere. There was a time for it where people were really celebrating this sort of culture. People were really into the Summer of Love. People loved that. And now it's more kind of like a sideshow. The kids that you see in the hate street, you know, you see them as like, oh, like, haha, like they're a leftover remnant of the Summer of Love. But they're still the same kids. They're still the same kids with the same kind of hurts, you know, and that I think we need to be looking at as a society, that the same hurts and the same trauma that sent those kids to San Francisco all those decades ago for a Summer of Love is still sending kids here today.
Another main difference is that there are millionaires and billionaires now living in San Francisco, $40 million condos. I mean, these kids live in front of some of these condos.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Oh, yes.
So that's also a major change. When mm-hmm. you're talking about how acceptance has changed, can you explore that a bit?
Yeah. It's a little tough, you know, when we have when you have all these tech billionaires and, you know, when they're walking to work and they're walking by all these tent encampments, you know, they don't really want to see them. They don't want to see these kids. They don't want to see these kids who are panhandling. They don't want to see these kids who are smelly because they haven't had a shower in a week, or they don't want to see them taking up space. And it's hard for them. It's hard for these kids to be cast off like this, to be cast off as less than and seen as less than and seen as not human beings. Because I don't mean to overgeneralize, because I'm sure there are people within the tech industry, within the billionaire group that we're talking about, who do not feel this way. But to look at this group of people as less than human and to look at them as the same as you would litter, that's dehumanizing, and that does a lot to somebody's sense of worth and sense of being. I mean, one thing we don't talk about either is about how even like a day, a night you spend on the streets, what that does to your psyche and what that does to you and how much more difficult it makes it for you to be able to function in society after spending any amount of time on the streets. Add to that the disdain and the rejection from society, the rejection from the sudden influx of wealth that's coming into this city. And it's a perfect recipe for disaster.
As you say, just spending one night on the street, you could be robbed, you could be beaten, you could be sexually assaulted.
You're always on guard. You can't relax. Some of these kids, you know, like they'll go into shelters after, like they'll go into like safe homes, and they'll talk about how their caseworkers and social workers will be like, all right, you know, you can take off your shoes when you go to sleep now. You don't have to sleep with your shoes on anymore. Mm. Or, you know, you don't have to bring your backpack with you to shower anymore. You don't have to always hold all your belongings with you. It's okay. That's how ingrained it is for them. They have to always be ready to grab their stuff and go.
What about the politics behind this? What did you hear from advocates you interviewed about the social safety net and how it's not there for many people, how there are so few options in a wealthy city like San Francisco to actually find a bed and get some help? I mean, yes, you can find food and you can find some help, but in terms of finding a home, finding safety, that's incredibly difficult.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, when it comes down to, I mean, homelessness, you solve homelessness with housing. That's what it is. You know, you need more housing, period. That's how you solve it. But as we've known, as we've encountered, you know, like throughout, we've encountered, you know, endlessly in San Francisco, we just do not have enough housing. We do not have enough low-income housing. We do not have enough homeless shelters. We don't have enough. And we need more.
Today we're speaking with Vivian Ho about her new book, Those Who Wander, America's Lost Street Kids. And let's hear next from Amy in Berkeley. Hi, Amy. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Vivian. I just wanted to say thank you so, so much for writing this book. It's very personal to me, and I'm so glad.
Well, thank
and
you.
I hope I don't get emotional when I'm talking because it brings up a lot. But I had 2 points I wanted to make. I just wanted to share one thing very quickly before telling my story. But years ago, I saw a documentary that was made by a filmmaker named Harry Mathias, who did a documentary about the street kids living on Telegraph Avenue. And this was like 25 years ago. And one of the things that really stuck to me from that documentary that has changed the way I interact, even in spite with my own story, is that one of the kids said one of the most painful things is when he asks for spare change and somebody walks by as if he's invisible. And that dehumanization of being invisible is so painful. And he said, even if they don't give me money, just to look at me and say, hey, hello, and sorry I can't give to you today, just acknowledges me
yes.
as a human being that I exist.
Yes.
And how important that is. And but there's other ways to give too, you know, money, food, whatever, especially for young people and for elders too. But when in 1974, I ran away from a sexually abusive household, and I knew that one of the main things that happens to girls is prostitution, and I so did not want that to happen, especially coming from sex abuse. And I read an article in the Chronicle, so thank you, Chronicle, about a place called Huckleberry House, which is a runaway shelter for teenagers, and that saved my life. And there are so few resources like that now, and it's just enraging that there aren't more resources for teenagers. So I just wanted to know, I'm very excited about your book, and I'm now one of those success stories from having gone to group homes, foster homes from teenage. I'm now teaching reading and writing at Cal, and I'm assigning the 57 bus to my students, and I teach freshmen, and I want to get your book and add it to my reading list. So
thank
you so much for what you're doing and for bringing this out. And I wanted to ask what there is going on now, or if you can talk a little bit before you're off the air about what people can do to advocate for more resources for these teens.
Amy, thank you so much for sharing your story. Like, I'm tearing up too. I'm so happy to hear. I'm just so happy to hear that you came out of that. I'm so happy. This is why I wanted to write the book. I wanted people to know that there is hope out there, and that we can make it out.
Amy, thank you so much for calling in. She mentioned the Huckleberry House,
mm-hmm.
which saved her.
It's still operating.
What other resources are in the city, and what is the status of those organizations? Because in some cases, like Homeless Youth Advocates, they had a home, basically, on Haight Street.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember going over there, and every time you walk in, it was full of kids who just needed a break.
Yeah.
They were sitting on couches, they were sleeping, they were taking a shower, just taking a break from the streets. But because of the high rents, they couldn't keep their place. And so now they're trying to operate out of a bus. I'm not sure if they've found a new place. We'd love to have an update on that. But what is the status of these organizations
that are doing work? It's so heartbreaking. It's so hard. It's so frustrating because we need more. We need so much more. But I mean, like the Homeless Youth Alliance is a great organization. They're still operating and they're still doing great work. Huckleberry House is still operating. They're doing great work as well. At the Crossroads is another great organization. But one organization that I worked really closely with for the book was taking it to the streets.
Right.
And it was fantastic organization, and it was just so wonderful. It was founded by Christian Grimes Kalinski, and he was a former street kid, and it was just such a smart concept because he would have these street kids come and volunteer and clean up Haight Street and kind of give them a sense of responsibility, because for so many of these kids, like, nobody taught them, okay, you have to have a job, you have to have chores. And so, like, you throw them into your first job, and they're like, well, I don't know. I have to show up. I don't know. I have to show up on time. I don't know. I have to be clean. I don't know. I have to wear a uniform. And so, like, he'll ease them into that by having volunteer jobs. And it was such a wonderful thing. And then they were giving back to the Haight Street community, and it was great. And they just got their own brick and mortar shop for them to hang out in. And they were writing, like, they were doing homework there. They were just hanging out, and it was wonderful. And they closed because they ran out of money. Mm. And it was just such a wonderful organization, and they were doing such good work, and they helped hundreds of kids, hundreds.
And you just have to wonder, how can that happen in a wealthy city like San Francisco?
Exactly. We have billionaires walking our streets, billionaires, and yet we have organizations like this that are doing such good work that are not just closing. And it breaks my heart.
If I remember correctly, you didn't quote any politicians in San Francisco in your book, but did you? I'm sure you've interviewed them over the years.
Oh, yes.
What do they say when you talk about these issues? What is happening? Why can't we fund these groups?
It's hard. I mean, everybody needs more funding. That's the problem. Everybody needs more funding, period. And that's what is always going to be the situation. And especially with homelessness, like, that's always, like, it's so hard. It needs so much more funding than we're giving it.
Well, and again, the question you ask is, how do we keep these kids from homelessness in the first place? It seems like, wouldn't you want to reach someone who's 13, 14, so they don't end up on the streets for decades?
But that's where it's really hard. And that's where, you know, I start off my book with a disclaimer, and it's probably the hardest disclaimer for anybody who's a journalist. It's, I do not have the answer.
Right.
Which is, like, that was excruciating for me to come to terms with. But I do not have an answer for this, because the problem is, how do we solve youth homelessness? Like, can we solve a broken foster care system? Can we solve abusive parents? Can we solve drug addiction? Can we solve mental health? There's so many factors that go into what drives children into the streets, what drives young people into the streets, and what keeps them there. We don't know. We can't solve everything. So much goes into breaking these kids' souls. All we can really do now is just hope that we can piece them together.
We have an email from Carolyn who says, the unanswered question is, how can we provide mental health service and for these young people a way to enter society as adults with some type of support? I lived at Mount St. Joseph's, an orphanage run by the Daughters of Charity. We were required to save money, most of the money we made at jobs in the summer, and we had various programs to teach us how to save, how to cook, how to shop. Also, we had mental health services if needed. Many of us stayed in contact with our group mother, a nun, or the various counselors. I also had the advantage of getting a union job at Joseph Magnin when I graduated high school and moved out, which gave me medical insurance and a paying job, allowing me to attend college and get a degree. Where are these services now? How can the tech industry help? These services just don't seem to be there, as well as well-paying jobs.
That's a really good point. I mean, mental health services are just, that's so needed. These kids have gone through so much trauma, and just, I mean, it's absolutely insane that we don't have enough services for them. I mean, Christian told me this one story about this one kid who would curl up into a ball every time he heard a loud noise when he first came into the service, and how little by little they had to coax him out of that. And I mean, he was a success story. He ended up getting a job. He ended up being okay. They figured out that if he got, like, a little headphones, he could play music quietly to himself, and he could function like that. But it's like he had, like, untreated autism that was basically, and that was the whole situation. But it's just like, how, like, we need to be helping these kids. Mm. So many of these kids need help, and we're not doing it.
We don't have that much time left, but there's so many stories. What other stories stood out for you that you'd like to share?
My goodness. It's hard, you know? There were so many stories, and there were some stories that were, what was hard for me, you know, because there are some where, you know, you just know the answer, right? You're like, okay, you need help. You know, you need to get into a program. You need to get housing. You need to get back to school, and you're going to get help, and you're going to be okay. That's it. But then there are other cases that, you know, the situation was not as clear-cut. There was this one girl I met, Momo, and she was a sweetheart, and she she was traveling around on a bus with her boyfriend, and she had suffered through some terrible, terrible trauma. She was essentially kidnapped, and she was when she first became homeless, she was kidnapped and essentially sold into a sex trafficking ring, and was just held hostage and raped repeatedly for she doesn't even know how long. And so she was dealing with some awful trauma, and I didn't know really how to help her. I didn't really know the right solution for that, you know? But she did. For her, she needed to keep traveling. She wasn't ready to go somewhere yet. And so we talked about this before. Is homelessness a choice? But that's not the question, right? It's like, do you have the ability to get out of this if you can? For Momo, she did. Momo did. Momo was traveling. She had a shelter. She had a bus that she could sleep in. She had places to go to. She had ways to make money. She was making crafts that she sold at concerts and festivals. And she was just working through what she suffered on her own terms. For that, you know, that was kind of an eye-opening moment for me too, that not everybody has the same recovery. And I think we need to also be very patient and open about that as well. Some of them need to keep traveling, and we need to understand that.
And work out what they're dealing with.
Exactly.
Rather than being a structured, maybe going to therapy twice a week and living in a home with mom and dad is not
exactly
for everyone for a variety of reasons.
Exactly. And in this situation, you know, the question of homeless by choice, no, that's not the question. Do you have the ability to get out of this if you want to?
Right.
Momo could. Momo had shelter. Momo was okay. And so I think that was the best case scenario for Momo.
This quote in your book, I think, says so much about what you're talking about. Too many kids find themselves on the streets because they had no one who showed them enough love to take care of them. So when they find other kids who are willing to fill that familial void, they become attached quickly and without a question. For too many, the family they form on the streets is the only family they have, and from that deep bond comes a desperate and unwavering allegiance.
Yeah. It's beautiful and terrifying at the same time to see the sort of bonds that are formed. There are people I spoke to who are off the streets and no longer there, who are still in touch with their street families. Because I mean, that is your family. You know, they had your back. They were your protectors. And I mean, it's a deep bond. It's very, very great. But at the same time, like, it's bad because, you know, when you're young, you're still susceptible to peer pressure. You're still susceptible to groupthink. And then when you have a bunch of kids together at once with undying loyalty to each other, it can be a recipe for disaster.
And especially for women, you write about the many dangers that women and young women, girls, let's say girls, because they're so young, you write, many would rather pee on themselves and smell like stale urine as a defense mechanism rather than be clean and get raped.
Yeah.
That's
awful.
Awful.
It's, when Momo told me her story, I wanted it to be this awful, salacious, like, sex trafficking ring. I just wanted it to be this one-off, awful thing. So she told me it happened in Oregon. So I went to Portland, Oregon. I spoke around and I was asking people. I'm like, do you know about this weird underground cult sex trafficking ring that's happening? Because like, you just want it to be this one terrible thing, this one-off terrible thing. And it turns out what happened to Momo is actually just very common. It's not a terrible sex trafficking ring. It's just sexual violence against women, especially vulnerable women. I went and I spoke to just a random woman on the street, just completely in passing, and I brought up this. I'm like, hey, have you ever heard about, like, you know, like this sex trafficking or anything? She's like, no, but my friend got raped the other day. And I'm just like, oh my God. It's just, ugh.
Final minute, Vivian. Those of us who see this every day, what can we do to help, to try to change things?
I think the important thing, what the caller said before, we got to look these kids in the eye. We have to treat them like human beings, and we have to show compassion. I may not have the great solution in this book. You know, I don't have the solution for ending foster care for solving the foster care issue for, you know, abusive parents, drug addiction, mental illness. I don't have that great solution. But what I hope to show with this book is that we can show a little bit more compassion to each other and to this piece of the population.
Vivian Ho is an award-winning journalist. She writes for The Guardian, and she's author of Those Who Wander, America's Lost Street Kids. Vivian, thank you for this important book, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show, and thanks to Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. You can find more information about Vivian Ho's work at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.